May it please the court. Canon 3C3 requires a presiding judge to take reasonable measures to assure that judges over whom the presiding judge exercises supervisory authority engage in, quote, the proper performance of their judicial responsibilities, unquote.
What was her supervisory authority at that time? At the moment, now, after some action in the legislature, the court clerk is now under the auspices of the court. At the time, though, I'm not sure what the time was the clerk elected or appointed.
I'm not talking about the clerk. I'm talking about the presiding judge, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just saying about the presiding judge.
The presiding judge.
Judge over, okay.
The presiding judge under the Code of Judicial Conduct has a responsibility to engage in supervisory authority to make sure the judges within their supervision engage in the proper performance of their judicial responsibilities. That's a requirement the presiding judges have.
And then again, next question is, back to the same one, what supervisory authority did the judge have over clerks, the presiding judge?
Well, they have the authority I mean, you're talking about the situation in the city of St. Louis versus...
Yeah, the city of St. Louis, yes, exactly. That's where we're talking about the judges.
I think that they have a responsibility under the Code of Judicial Conduct to maintain the proper performance of the clerk's responsibilities. If the clerk isn't appointed by the judge...
At this time, were the judges were the clerks elected or were they appointed at the time of these issues?
The time of these issues, which would have been in 2001, it's my understanding that they were, I'm not sure, Judge.
As 2001 they were elected.
Or 2011, excuse me, I'm not sure.
Okay.
The problem for a presiding judge, however, is that while they have an ethical duty to supervise judges in their circuit, they have few teeth to enforce their supervision upon those judges who do not perform according to the measured standards. When a presiding judge tells an associate to arrive at work on time and she refuses to do so, the presiding judge must rely on this commission and this court to enforce his authority. Judge Omer, the presiding judge, suffered a, quote, parade, unquote, of attorney complaints in the spring of 2011 about the respondent's practice of arriving late to court. Per his own ethical requirements, he met with the respondent and told her that the attorneys want to conclude their business in Division 25 early. He reminded her of the local rule setting hours of court from 9 to 5, and, contrary to the argument in respondent's brief, told her, quote, that's when I expected her to be there, unquote.
There's nothing that requires you to have dockets at 9 a.m. I mean, you don't have dockets from 9 to 5. You have three or four dockets. But she did set a docket then. But nothing in the rules requires her to be on the bench at
No, she can set the dockets at 3 or 2 or 10. Okay. The point here is, though, if you're going to set the docket at 9, you ought to be there at 9. Respondent ignored the instructions of her presiding judge and continued being tardy until November or December of 2011. Also, contrary to the assertions in the reply brief, it was the Division 25 bailiff of 10 years, Tammy Hogan, not Judge Omer, who testified that prior to respondent taking over Division 25, judges took the bench between 8 and 9. Judge Omer did testify that when he was assigned to Division 25, he took the bench in Division 25 as scheduled at 9 a.m. One of the exacerbating circumstances in this case is respondent's lack of truthfulness. The commission found that respondent's insistence during her testimony and furthermore in her reply brief that she arrived at the courthouse at 9:15 was just not credible. This court, giving substantial consideration and due deference to the commission's ability to judge the credibility of witnesses as required in Re Voorhees, should believe the testimony of private attorney David Stokely, the assistant prosecutor Adelinka Faletti, and the public defender Ramona Gao, who recalled that respondent was not usually in chambers until 9:50 to 10:30, not 9:15 as respondent insists. Respondent's lack of credibility was also manifest in her responses to the commission and her testimony before the commission about her statements regarding tearing the motion, Exhibit 26, out of the Williams file. Assessing the credibility of witnesses, the commission believed Clerk Tyler, not responded, that respondent told Ms. Tyler in regards to tearing the motion out of the court file that they would, quote, take this to our graves, unquote.
Can you clarify something for me about that? What's written on Exhibit 26 says that, by the attorney, said that the court clerk denied this motion without a judge present and without allowing defense counsel an opportunity to argue the motion. But I have, is there any, it was never actually denied, was it? There's no written document denying the motion or docket entry denying the motion, and later on it was granted, is that right?
Later on, yes, it was granted later on, but the reason for the motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute was the issue of how many continuances the state had had.
Isn't it a contested issue whether it is a motion?
Yes, they contest. The judge maintains that it was, quote, an improper order, unquote.
Well, because our law is that we look at substance over form, and it is captioned motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute, but it has no signature line for the pleading party and contains things that wouldn't normally be in a motion. So the question, I mean, isn't that an issue we need to resolve, whether it in fact was a proper motion to dismiss?
Well, it's, as you've pointed out, it's entitled motion. The actual order that dismissed the case is on the same form. It too is not signed by an attorney. Yes, it should have been signed by an attorney. The judge certainly knew who filed it, that it was at least a public defender. She might not have known which public defender filed it.
Because it doesn't have any information. It has the caption of the case, but it has nothing to indicate that it was filed by an attorney on behalf of that client. So the question is, it normally would be a form for a judge to respond to an oral motion to dismiss. Could that be a proper characterization?
Well, that's one way to look at it, but it certainly says motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute in bold letters.
The problem, I mean, a motion has to be signed. You sign it as an attorney, as an officer of the court, you signed it, you're asking for some relief. This is a really odd document, but it's not an acceptable motion. It's also an odd form for an order. How is this necessarily, what was the commission's interpretation of what this meant, that it was in the file, and why was it important, or the significance of it being torn up as opposed to remaining in the file? Explain that in juxtaposition to the sanction that the commission found appropriate.
The commission determined that this was a motion, and that the judge knew it was a motion, and the judge had an idea who filed it. It was significant because of the interlineation, which was an indication of the problem that was occurring with the clerk having apparent authority to run the docket. This was a significant issue that had come up in conferences.
But the statement there is not accurate, right? Because, in fact, the motion was not granted or denied until the court came back.
Doesn't that really get to who has the authority to do what in the courtroom? I mean, obviously what was going on here was that the attorney was trying to memorialize what he perceived as an injustice or an inappropriate action on behalf of the clerk. And if the clerk doesn't turn the record on or turn the tape on because she doesn't want a record of that, how else is the attorney supposed to make a record of what he perceives as an injustice?
That's true. That would be the commission's position.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish.
No, go ahead.
Part of the record seems to indicate, or the argument on behalf of the respondent indicates, that if the attorney had wanted a judge to rule on the motion, that was available in another courtroom I can't remember if it was next door or down the hall. Is that correct, that the attorney, the practice in the court was to take the file to a different division, or is that not an accurate statement?
Well, that certainly was the argument. There is a local rule that requires that if the judge is going to be absent, the judge should make arrangements for who the replacement attorney is going to be. It's supposed to post notice that as to who that attorney is going to be. So an attorney would come in, or who the judge was going to be, so that when the attorney comes in, they would know who to go to. This particular attorney, Mr. Oliver, did not think it was appropriate to do that because of the motion he was making was based upon the unwritten rule in Division 25 that after three continuances for the state, the case would be dismissed for lack of prosecution.
So he was wanting the clerk to do it even though the judge wasn't there.
Well, it was his opinion that the clerk had that authority because that's the way the clerk had been operating.
So his complaint was not that he thought the clerk was ruling, though there was no order entered, but that he didn't like her ruling?
Right, and he didn't have an opportunity to talk to a judge. Yes, he was trying to say I wanted to talk to a judge. There wasn't a judge here, and the judge made this ruling.
Well, and that's what the question went to. Was there a judge though? A judge was available in another court.
Well, there was judges all the time available somewhere, somewhere in that circuit. There could have been a judge that could have been tracked down. Yes,
I want to focus you a little bit more on. You're almost running out of time on the complaints that you have about the actions of the clerk doing duties that were improper. In no place do you accuse the clerk of signing the judge's name, do you?
No.
Are you using a stamp inappropriately?
She used the stamp a couple of times when the judge was on vacation. But there's a court rule that allows for the stamp to be used as long as the judge authorizes it. The main problem here was the appearance. The judge just wasn't there, and the clerk was making these announcements, and the attorneys, the citizens, thought it was the clerk who was functioning as a judge.
So the announcements are improper, in your opinion?
Well, the fact that there isn't
a dismissal.
The fact that there isn't close supervisory control by the judge, which is improper.
My question is, all of the actions by the clerk, would those have been proper if the judge had been in chambers or, if not proper in chambers, on the bench?
Certainly, if she had been on the bench, that would be perfectly all right. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Even in chambers, it's dangerous, but I don't think it's going to be per se improper.
You're saying here, if I understand it, the clerk didn't say, okay, this is not contested, I'll bring it to the judge, but the clerk would say, this is going to be granted, this is going to be denied.
Right.
And that gave the appearance that the clerk made the decision.
Yes.
What if an attorney disagreed with that? You know, how could they have their grievance or disagreement heard if they disagree with the clerk's decision to...
Well, then they'd have to have a seat, presumably, and wait for the judge to show up. And the judge wasn't showing up until later on in the morning.
Now, if the judge had been there, but they took up all these matters first at the docket, and then the court's procedure was to then wait till the end of the docket to take up contested matters, wouldn't that have been the same thing in terms of the delay? That whether the judge was there or not, if you're dealing with all the uncontested matters first, and then you take up the contested matters later in that docket or in the next docket, it wouldn't have, the amount of delay to do that wouldn't have been any greater had the judge been on the bench than the judge being in chambers, would it?
Well, if the judge had been on the bench and two attorneys were discussing whether a continuance should have been granted, the judge could have made that decision right there and they could have left. Instead, they're told
they
have a
seat. So part of it was you would disagree that you should hold over the contested ones till after all the uncontested are done.
No, I don't have a problem with doing that. What I have a problem with is if you're going to have a docket set at 9 o'clock, you ought to be there at 9 o'clock, if not at 8:30, to take care of the uncontested matters. And then at 9 o'clock, you're there. The people see that you're there. You show the flag as an attorney or as the judge. The people think the judge is the person administering justice, not the clerk.
And I certainly understand your argument about the appearance, but I was getting further to some of the details of any specific harm in addition to the appearance of the clerk running the docket.
Well, If things are passed a second call, then, of course, the judge can rule on those things. And, in fact, when the clerk makes announcements that a judge would normally make, and then the judge comes in on second call and then basically authorizes those announcements, then the judge has, in fact, made the ruling, not the clerk, because the clerk has no authority to do it.
Right.
I mean, that's a given.
And is that just last one, and I know I've taken up more than your time.
Yeah, I'm flashing.
On Exhibit 26, I take it what was testified to that the clerk announced that it would be denied, even though it, in fact, never was denied in writing.
That's what Mr. Oliver said.
Okay,
that
thank
the
you.
Clerk
thank you.
Announced stated, it. You know, that will be denied.
But what is in the record, if anything, regarding the practices in other courtrooms in that court, in that circuit?
Well. The bailiff of 10 years said that this is the only, had been in that Division 25 for 10 prior years, said that no other judge had ever operated this way in Division 25. This
the
is
bailiff
the first time
also
ever.
Said that she got there between 9:15, as only by about 9:15, and the commission disregarded his testimony.
There were two bailiffs. There was the most recent bailiff, and then there was the bailiff who had been there, Tammy Hogan, for 10 years prior through a number of judges.
So only one bailiff said she got there on time. Well, at 9:15.
The most recent bailiff said that, yes, sir.
Okay.
But not the one who'd been there for 10 years.
Okay.
Thank you. You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Judge White, I know your time is limited, so I'd like to ask a question once again. What's we don't hear many of these cases. In the lawyer review, we hear the cases de novo, and we can decide the facts, apparently. What's the standard review of the commission?
The standard of review of the court is that you can reweigh the evidence and the testimony that came in, but you have to give deference to the credibility of the witnesses. So that's the standard of review. You can look at the record and make your own determinations and draw your own conclusions.
Thank you.
Is it different than for attorneys then?
No.
Because I think for attorneys, we refine the facts. So we make the determination of the credibility and make the fact finding.
That may be correct, Judge. I don't know. Well, I guess I need to give my introduction first, and then I'll give it a shot. May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors, and Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Ronnie White. I'm here on behalf of Respondent Judge Barbara Peoples. The main issue before the court this morning is simply this, whether or not Judge Peoples should be removed from the bench. And the judges have already started to ask questions, and it seemed to be some interest about my point three that we raised on appeal, which is the matter of the proposed motion, which we contend at best was a proposed order. Missouri Supreme Court Rule 55.03 clearly states that motions shall be signed and that the attorney's address should be on there, and it has specific requirements. Those requirements are not discretionary, they're mandatory because the rule itself says shall.
If it's not a motion, but it's a proposed order, does that affect the wrongfulness of what she did?
I think it does, because if it's not a valid motion and it's a proposed order, then it's not a record, as the commission contends, that's required to be kept by law.
Counselor,
it's just a proposed motion.
Excuse me. One of the reasons I asked the question previously is if a clerk is running court without a judge and doesn't have a court reporter, or in the situation of associate circuit judge, the Sony Gold running, so there's no record of what the clerk is doing, and the lawyer perceives that the clerk makes a ruling that's required by the judge, how, other than making this type of record and putting that in the file, could the lawyer make a record of what he perceived there was as an injustice?
Judge,
whether we call it a motion or whatever, obviously he's trying to make a record of something that he perceives as prejudicial to his client, and absent writing it down and filing it, since there's no record going on, how would he ever get a ruling?
And I think that's absolutely what happened here. He wanted to memorialize the discussion that had taken place, but even that didn't make it a motion. When the clerk accepted that it was file stamped and indicated a date, which meant it was received by the court, the commission contends that this clerk was acting like a judge. Here was the chance for her to truly act like a judge, where she could have written on there, denied, and stamped the judge's signature. But she did what she was supposed to do. She held it for the judge to rule on it when she saw it.
Well, if I understand, in answer to Judge Fisher's question, you're saying he could have signed it and made it into a motion.
He could have signed it.
And that would have been?
Yes, Judge. He could have signed it and filled out all the requirements of Rule 55.03, mm-hmm. made it into a motion, and then it goes into the file, and the judge would review it later.
What about, but then what does it matter what it's called, though, if it's when we get to the point of removing it from the court file, why does it matter what it's called at that point in time? If the lawyer's trying to memorialize what he perceives as an oral motion that he made on the record, why wouldn't removing that from the file be just as offensive as removing a motion that was filed?
Judge, I agree with you. The act of removing the paper from the file, no matter what you call it, be it a motion or proposed order, okay, or just a piece of paper, that was clearly improper, and that's not the kind of conduct you would look from a judge.
And that's really the issue that we should focus on, regardless of what we call it.
But in addition to that, Judge, the commission contends that she violated a criminal statute by taking it out, and that's where we contend that there was no crime, because in addition to proving that she knowingly crumbled up the paper, they have the burden of proving that she did it knowingly, knowing that she was required by law to keep that in the file.
And it's your position that she was required to keep a motion, but not required to keep a memo of just memorializing what had occurred?
Correct, because that memo, Judge, says so ordered, and it could be construed as a proposed order or an order.
Suppose he had turned it over and written the same thing on the back. Would it have been a crime to crumple that up and throw it in the trash can?
I don't think so.
Well, the question is, can anyone, an attorney or anyone else, make an official document and file it in the court file to memorialize what happened in the courtroom when it's not in a proper pleading form? And I mean, I've never seen a case where an attorney decides they want to make a docket entry of what occurred. They have to put it in a proper form for it to be properly filed, don't they?
And Your Honor, that's my understanding of why Rule 55.03 is there, to make sure that motions and pleadings in the court files are in the proper form, so everybody will know what it is. If not, they could write on a napkin, have it file stamped, and that napkin goes in a court file.
Well, in any, the nature of it trying to be in the form of a kind of docket entry or record of what occurred in the courtroom, an attorney doesn't have the right to do that, do they?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, the attorney should be familiar with the Supreme Court rules of court. The rules of court tells you specifically what a motion needs to contain and how the form should be.
On the broader issue of, I'm very concerned about the appearance that the clerk was deciding how matters would be ruled. And if I understand, everyone agrees that appearance should not have been given.
Judge, here's what we agree to. We agree that the clerk was a little bit more intimate and involved in the process. Maybe she was more animated in her announcing of the document. But they can't point to one case or one anything that she actually exercised the power that was inherently with the judge.
She did the judge authorize her to say, this motion's granted, this motion's denied, as opposed to saying, the judge's usual practice is to grant these kind of motions, I'll bring it back to her? Do we have any transcripts, or what do we know knew?
I don't know if that's clear in the record, but what is clear, that the clerk made announcements, that it's a bulk docket division with 50 to 200 cases, and how it works is, if you don't have a contested matter, you go in and get a date from the clerk. And let me say this to you honors, this is not a clerk sitting in a corner by herself calling off dates with discretion. Those dates actually come from the docket controller. They're not controlled by Judge Peoples, and they're not controlled by Ms. Tyler. And everybody.
The continuance dates? Or
the continuance dates.
Oh, okay.
Because those dates have to be in tandem with Division 16, which is where those cases go. It's the criminal assignment division. So the people in the room do not have discretion over those dates. Those dates are given to the clerk, not to the judge. The circuit attorney is present. The public defender is present. Private attorneys are present. The bond commissioners are present. And the bailiff is present. So there are at least five, six people in that room. And in some courts, the bailiff called the docket. And Ms. Tyler's testimony was this. Mr. Smith asked her, where did you learn how to call a docket like that? From Judge Peoples? No. I learned how to call dockets like that from the clerks that were in that division before I ever came in there. And I think early on there was some question about how are these clerks assigned. Judge Peoples didn't hire this clerk. She was hired by the circuit clerk. And at time of these incidents, the circuit clerk was an elected position. And those clerks in those courtrooms are patronage workers. They're placed there by somebody other than the judge.
There is a lot of evidence in the record that there was widespread concern that this was an inappropriate practice and the clerk was called by the title judge. There also is the argument made on behalf of your client that that complaint was not made to her. That wasn't a discussion that she had with the presiding judge. That the only complaint that was made that she discussed was tardiness. Can you tell me what is in the record?
Your Honor, I think that's correct. The only complaint that she got from or discussion she had with the presiding judge was whether or not she was on the bench at 9 o'clock. He never said to her anything about these other issues. And one other thing that's telling, when the presiding judge testified, he was asked, "Do you have any not personal knowledge of any motion or dismissal or warrant that was issued by the clerk?" And he said, no. I mean, there is absolutely no impact on the administration of justice by the appearance of the clerk calling the
doctor. What happened is two issues. One is, whether it's criminal or not, can the judge just take something out of the file that's in there, crumple it up, and throw it away? Is that
Judge Tiedemann, I don't think that's proper at all. But I don't think it's criminal. And I don't know that it rises to the level of misconduct, because the court can consider the extent of the circumstances that existed at the time of the act. She saw what she thought was an improper piece of paper in the file, and she snatched it out of the file and threw it away. And that was wrong. But did she do it in an attempt to cover up something? No. Right after she did that, the attorney standing in front of her made an oral motion, not a written motion, and she used the form similar to the one she had just crumbled up and threw away.
So she didn't hide it.
She didn't hide it.
The lawyer in front of her knew she was doing it.
And if she was doing something untoward, she would have done it in chambers, or she would have done it in the middle of the night.
Well,
how does that explain the conversation with the prosecuting attorney afterwards? Wasn't there some conversation about, or was that a different matter dealing with the?
No, that's the same matter, Judge. When Whitney Tyler came to the judge and said, the circuit attorney has asked me to take a polygraph, the judge said, you need to hire a lawyer. Didn't encourage her one way or the other. And after that, the judge picked up the phone and called the prosecutor and said, I'm calling you about a piece of paper that's supposedly missing from a file. And I don't know how much more candid you can get than to say, I did it. And what she said in that conversation was, I want to take responsibility for what I did. I don't want Whitney or anybody else to. I removed a piece of paper from the file because I deemed it to be a proposed order or an order.
It looks like in the record that Judge Peoples has agreed that she violated the code of conduct in talking to a reporter in the McCall case.
That is correct, Your Honor, and we didn't raise that in our points on appeal, but we did mention it and the facts to alert the court that issue is out there.
Is there anything else at all that she admits that she's done that may have violated the code of conduct? You said earlier that maybe the animation of her clerk was improper for her to allow that to occur. Is
I'm
that
not
a violation
sure.
of the code?
absent any impact to the administration of justice, I wouldn't think so, because where's the harm? She could have counseled that clerk and said, don't.
Isn't the appearance of impropriety something that the code forbids too, though? And didn't this create, allowing the clerk to clothe herself in this, not supervising her sufficiently, create that add to that appearance?
It can, Your Honor. But the problem here is there was a diversion of that. I mean, some people said it was, some people said it wasn't. The judge said that there was a parade of lawyers coming to him. The testimony was that that docket has 50 to 200 lawyers a day that comes through there.
But if they're joking that the clerk is Judge Tyler, doesn't that says that can't be how she learned to call the docket. She clearly elaborated, it seems like, from the record, from what she originally learned, even though calling the docket and calling the cases maybe how she learned to do it. It sounds like she expanded her role over time, perhaps.
And that's probably right, but I don't know that was brought to the attention of the judge. And I mean, who would have brought it to her? I mean, even though these lawyers were agitated by the fact that she would start a little bit later, one of the lawyers that testified, Terry Niehaus, said, yeah, I was agitated or concerned about it. But when I went back and asked the judge why did she come out after the initial call, it made sense. He said it actually made sense to get rid of those matters that were non-contested and save the contested matters for later.
Did she admit to being tardy, or did she see that as a violation of the code of conduct?
We do not see that as, because there was no definite start time. The presiding judge in his own testimony said, I kind of mentioned to her you ought to get out there at 9 o'clock. And I would say this to the court, if the rule is now going to be that if you have a 9 o'clock docket, that you, the judge, have to be on the bench to call that docket, then I would ask this court to give Judge Peoples the benefit of the doubt going forward and give her an opportunity to conform to that rule, because that hasn't been the rule prior to now.
So the conversation between her and Judge Omer was not, you are supposed to be, like if when I came on the court, if Chief Justice Limbaugh said, come to court at 7, I'd say, you sure you don't want to be there at 6:30? I mean, it wasn't like sitting down with her and saying, do you want to, do you understand? I'd like you to be there at 9. That's when you say you're supposed to be there, or that's the custom or whatever.
Your Honor, that conversation is not in the record below. Judge, I realize my time is up. Could I just take a moment to sum up? What I'd like to say on behalf of the respondent is this. Yes, she made a few mistakes in involving her judicial time on the bench. She talked to the press when she shouldn't have. She probably should have closely supervised the clerk, and it was clearly wrong to throw a piece of paper out of the file. But I don't think any of that stuff rises to the level sufficient to warrant removal from the bench. I think that this court can do what it has to do without removing Judge Peoples.
Is there any lesser sanction that you think is appropriate?
To be honest, Your Honor, I struggle with that. And I know you noticed in my brief that I didn't suggest any appropriate sanction because I didn't want to appear to invade the province of the court. But now that you've asked, I think that the correct one would probably be between an admonition or a public reprimand for two reasons. One, it would get the attention of the judge, but it would say to the public as well that we, the Supreme Court, take seriously the conduct of our judges.
Can you address how sanctions other than disbarment would affect her ability to continue serving as a judge?
I think if she were suspended, it would, because then we'd be back to the same problem that we brought us here. Somebody else would have to do the work. And in addition to that, she may struggle when she goes back to the bench to serve as a judge, because then lawyers will know, well, you can file a complaint against her, and she's going to be timid in her rulings and ability to judge.
Go ahead.
Part of the record is that, and I believe the commission believed it, that her clerk testified that she told her not to be truthful about her removing the document from the record. Could you address that and what her position is regarding that evidence?
The clerk was interviewed at least 5 times, Judge. Every time she was interviewed, her testimony got better. She didn't tell anybody that she said, let's take it to our graves, until she actually talked to the circuit attorney the second time. Then when she testified before the commission, she indicated that the judge said, let's keep this among ourselves. all of Whitney Tyler's testimony is uncorroborated. It just boiled down to he said, she said, and I don't know how you prove it or disprove it.
You know, your statement that her testimony got better, it got better in terms of the perspective of those that would say that she was actually trying to conspire with the judge.
It got better in terms of her trying to save herself.
Right.
She realized that as time went on, she was in trouble for this because people were talking to her about it. So it got better. But when she was initially contacted, she denied knowing anything about the doctor.
Thank you.
If there's nothing further, thank you, Your Honor.
Regarding discipline, and in lawyer discipline, it's very sophisticated, and they have lots of different options, including suspension, stay suspension, probation. Do you have anything like that in the judicial system?
Well, your choices are reprimand, suspension from office without pay for a period of time, and removal. The preamble says that this is a decision you make not so much about punishing the judge, but about what is best for the integrity of the judiciary. And I would ask this court to consider the fact that the commission, the six-member commission, assessing the credibility of witnesses, found that this witness, the respondent, was not credible, and that she was not truthful.
Five of the six, but I couldn't find in the record. Who was the sixth person?
Well, all six found the findings of fact to be correct. One dissented as to the recommendation. Well, we usually don't reveal that,
okay.
But if you're ordering me to do that, I will do so.
No.
She's had no prior disciplinary issues, has she?
No.
And how many years has she been on the bench?
I don't know, Judge.
Since
1990? She's been on the bench for 12 years.
Yeah, 1990, okay. So those are mitigating factors that, do you weigh that in?
How long she's been on the bench?
Well, I mean, I know that can go either way, but the fact that she's had no prior discipline.
Well, yes, certainly. That's a mitigating factor, but also a worsening factor is the fact that she wasn't truthful with the commission, and this was a pattern of conduct, that it went on, her being late and not supervising her clerk went on for a long time after the...
Were there any issues on prior dockets before she got the bulk docket? Were there any complaints about her handling?
No. Okay. Nothing that would be appropriate to mention.
How long had she had the bulk docket, or less?
This was a year, 2011. And the complaints started shortly after she started showing up late. And in the spring, Judge Omer went and talked to her. And then in November or December, she started showing up on time. I would point out to the commission very quickly that when Exhibit 26 was destroyed, Clerk Tyler's testimony that the only people at the bench at that time were her and the judge. There was no defense.
Well, she was in open court, though, is that right?
She was in open court, but there's a lot of people there, and it was just a conversation between her and the clerk. And the clerk said that it would have been very difficult for someone else to have heard the conversation. The court might also want to take a look at Court Operating Rule 8N, which is a discussion of what goes into a file and, you know, what can be taken out of a file. And nowhere in that operating rule does it say that a motion can be taken out of a file. I see my time is about up. I would ask the court to continue to give the commission the benefit of the doubt in terms of assessing the credibility of witnesses, and to adopt the commission's recommendation for what we consider the integrity of the judiciary, and remove respondent from the bench.
I want to ask, what's your that's your understanding of the review? Is it? Give the commission the benefit of the doubt, almost like Murphy versus Karen?
Well,
do we review this like we do attorney discipline under the same standard, or is there a special one?
There's a special one. You're supposed to give due deference to the commission's ability to assess the credibility of witnesses, and then you apply your own preponderance of the evidence to the record.
Evidence as the facts found by the commission.
That's correct. I can go back to the In re Steinle case, a case I argued before this court 30 years ago, 653 Southwest 2nd, 201. in which the court said, quote, a strong case can be made that the Supreme Court ought to defer to the findings of the commission, and failure to give the commission's findings substantial consideration and weight nullifies its purpose.
So is what did we find in 93? Did we rule contrary to that in 93?
No. That's when you, I think that's the Voorhees case you're referring to, and I think in that case you came and said that due deference to be given to the commission's ability to assess the credibility of witnesses.
So the rules don't provide the deference, but the case law does?
The case law does.
Why would this be different than the deference we give to disciplinary hearing commission findings before held by the lawyer disciplinary process?
I'm not sure. I guess you'd have to ask the court in Ray Voorhees as to why they, you know.
Well, if you could advise this court as to, are there any reasons?
We're a constitutional commission, and we have our own authority and our own rules, and it's kind of generalized. It doesn't give specifics, the Constitution, Article 5, Section 24, but it sets up the situation where the commission has the hearing and the court reviews it.
Counselor, the record of this proceeding doesn't provide any video or anything like that where this court could independently judge the credibility of the witnesses?
No. You've got the transcript and you've got the commission's findings.
Does the constitutional provision address the standard we should apply?
No.
Okay.
I don't believe it does.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. The case will be taken under submission.